Genealogy by Tim, Season 5, Episode 1, recorded January 25th, 2025. It's great to be back into researching. This month I'd like to tell you about some progress I've made finding lost souls. There were 3 family members whose death and or burial locations weren't quite clear to me with the help of the transcription efforts of the Jewish Genealogical and Archival Society of Greater Philadelphia of the burial records at Har Yehuda Cemetery. I was able to discover the final resting place of baby Selma Anflick, who died before her first birthday in 1933. Also, with the help of FamilySearch.org's experimental full-text search, I was able to find the resting place of 9-year-old Goldie Schachter, who died in 1900 in Richmond, Virginia. And I've discovered even more evidence that Elizabeth Atwood Hawkins, mother of Diamond Match Company CEO and Oregon timberman Russell Hawkins, is in fact buried at Fernwood Cemetery, despite that cemetery not being able to pull up any records of her burial. She died in 1909. Burial locations of these 3 individuals had gone unknown until my research efforts this month, and I'll tell you all about those this month on Genealogy by Tim. I'll start off with my discoveries at the Har Yehuda Cemetery in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, in search of the final resting place of baby Selma Anflick, who died before her first birthday on the 8th of January, 1933. Last summer, in Season 4, Episode 7, I mentioned some excitement at finding a record of Selma Anflick's burial on the website of JewishGen.org. That burial record got there on JewishGen.org after a transcription effort on the part of the Jewish Genealogical and Archival Society of Greater Philadelphia. I learned about that effort through one of its volunteers, Walter Spector, who was a member of the First Friday Genealogy Group in Philadelphia. The record was discovered because of JewishGen.org's robust search algorithm, which finds alternate spellings. The proper spelling of the name is Selma Anflick, A-N-F-L-I-C-K, but this was transcribed in the original records of the Har Yehuda Cemetery as Selma Henflick, H-E-N-F-L-I-C-K, and that spelling discrepancy is the reason that attendants at the Har Yehuda Cemetery were unable to find a record of Selma Anflick when I first went to look for her, probably about a decade ago. I'll just give a little background on who Selma Anflick is exactly, how I'm related. My maternal grandfather, Morris Anflick, was born in 1922 in Philadelphia. His father, Henry Anflick, was born in Odessa in 1886. He came to America in July of 1901. He had an older brother, Louis, or we believe he's a half-brother. Louis was about 10 years older, born in 1876, and he came to America in January of 1899 at the age of 22, apparently the first of his family to do that. Louis married Esther Leibowitz, and they had 8 children: Samuel, born in 1902, Edith, born in 1903, Charles, born in 1904, Celia, born in 1907, Archie, born in 1911, Sydney, born in 1913, Lillian, born in 1917, and Natalie, born in 1924. Louis was a hairdresser by trade, although later in his life he switched profession to music store owner, and at least 3 of his children took up music as a profession. Samuel, born in 1902, was a violin player who traveled from New York to Detroit and back, playing with such legendary musicians as Tommy Dorsey and Bix Beiderbecke. Edith, who was born in 1903, later married a Willie Singer, and she played piano at a silent movie theater called The Ideal in Philadelphia. And Sidney, who was born in 1913, became a music writer known professionally as Sid Flick. He married a Mona Merlinski, And they had some children here in Philadelphia before the family moved out to California. So Sidney Anflick, otherwise known as Sid Flick, would have been a cousin of my grandfather. And Selma was his third child, born in 1932. Selma died here in Philadelphia before the family packed up and moved to California to start their life there. And that branch of the family, of course, has grown, but some part of them has been left here. And I went out to Har Yehuda Cemetery to go find her. The cause of death listed on baby Selma's death certificate is hydrocephalus, which is a buildup of fluid in the cavities called ventricles, deep within the brain. Excess fluid, I'm reading from the Mayo Clinic, increases the size of the ventricles and puts pressure on the brain. And hydrocephalus can happen at any age, but it occurs more often among infants and among adults 60 and older. So the very young and the very old are susceptible to this ailment. In infants, hydrocephalus can result in an enlarged head. And I don't have any pictures of young Selma, so I personally don't know whether and to what extent Selma suffered from an enlarged head. But if you take a look at Google Images, you can see the variety in the severity of the head enlargement that hydrocephalus can cause, from relatively mild and barely noticeable to quite extreme. And again, I've never seen a picture, so I don't know quite what Selma was born with. But hydrocephalus is listed as the cause of death on her death certificate. And I'm reading from Google's AI overview, searching for the hydrocephalus mortality rates in the 1930s. It says that in the 1930s, the mortality rate for hydrocephalus was extremely high, nearing 100% for untreated cases. As effective treatment options were largely unavailable, even with the limited surgical interventions at the time, the mortality rate remained significantly high due to the lack of advanced techniques and high surgical risks. And if you just search for hydrocephalus mortality rates, it'll tell you about current mortality rates. It says hydrocephalus can be fatal if left untreated, with mortality rates ranging from 0 to 3% with treatment. So we've come a long way since the days of baby Selma. But Selma did die here in Philadelphia in 1933, and she was buried at Har Yehuda Cemetery. And for a long time, I did not know where, because her name was transcribed as Selma Henflick, H-E-N-F-L-I-C-K, in the records of the Har Yehuda Cemetery. So over my winter break, I went out to the cemetery in search of Selma's final resting place, which was identified as Section B-44, Line 2, Grave 43. And looking at the few scattered gravestones in Section B, rows 40 through 45, it's evident that this was a children's section of the cemetery, and children's sections of these old Jewish cemeteries are often mostly grass, very few gravestones. So if you find yourself directed to one of these locations, don't get your hopes up. You probably won't find a gravestone, and that was the case for Selma during this outing. I got pretty close to finding the exact location, and there is no grave there. But with the records of the Har Yehuda Cemetery now searchable through jewishgen.org, it's pretty easy to find any specific location. All you have to do is get to the general location where you think someone may be buried, read the names on the gravestones that you do see, get out your smartphone and enter those names into JewishGen's search form and see how far away you are from the grave you're looking for. And in my case, I was able to find the grave of another young child named Pata Lassen, who died on the 29th of July, 1935. I knew her grave was probably pretty close to Selma's grave, based on a few other surrounding grave locations that I was able to search. Pata Lassen's grave was written all in Hebrew, and I don't read Hebrew. I took a nice clear picture of that gravestone, and when I got home, I was able to use Google Translate with the image, and the translation was not perfect, but it was close enough for me to then go and enter Pata Lassen into the JewishGen search, and I found her grave to be Section B-45, Line 1, Grave 44. Compare that to Selma Anflick, who was buried at Section B-44, Line 2, Grave 43. So I was able to pinpoint the location of Selma's grave as one row behind and two spaces to the right of the gravestone for Pata Lassen. And I was able to take a picture of that place and include it in my family history research. No gravestone, unfortunately, but I am able to say to the Anflix of California, I've been to this location, I know where it is, and if in the future we want to erect a monument to baby Selma, we know where to put it. And then after I did all this locating and triangulation and all that stuff, I did try to visit the office. I thought I was within the hours at which the office was open. I went up to the doors and gave the doorknob a tug and found it to be locked. So I don't know if the hours posted at Har Yehuda Cemetery are entirely reliable, but that's why the Jewish Genealogical Society of Greater Philadelphia has undertaken this transcription project of the records of the cemetery so that folks can, you know, find their loved ones in the cemetery even if the office happens not to be open or even if they don't have access to the office because they live far away or for whatever reason, or if the name was not transcribed correctly in the cemetery records. So that was the case of Selma Anflick, a soul once lost but now found, and whose remains are at Section B44, Line 2, Grave 43 at Har Yehuda Cemetery. Another lost soul found again this month is that of Goldie Schachter. And Goldie Schachter's relationship to me is a little more distant. It's in the same Jewish maternal grandfather area of the family tree, but the common ancestor is a little earlier. Again, my grandfather was Morris Anflick, born in 1922. His father was Henry Anflick, born in 1886. His mother was Katie Karinchak, born in 1855. Now, Katie came to America from what is now the Ukraine with two of her daughters, Mary and Annie. They came together in 1903, September of 1903, after Lewis and Henry came over. And when Katie came to America, the person it said she was going to see on her passenger manifest was a brother-in-law named Aaron Schachter. But saying that someone's a brother-in-law doesn't uniquely identify that relationship, because it could be that Katie had a sister who married Aaron Schachter, or it could be that at some point Katie was married to a fellow named Schachter, and Aaron Schachter was this person's brother. And I had a hard time identifying exactly how that relationship went down between Katie Anflick and Aaron Schachter. He was stated to be a brother-in-law. I wasn't quite sure which way, though. But just before COVID happened, I met up with a gentleman who was a descendant of the aforementioned Willie and Edith Singer, and he believed that Katie Anflick had a sister, Anna, who married Aaron Schachter. And that was what I suspected as well, because I wasn't aware of any name change or evidence of any marriage to anybody named Schachter to Katie. So that's centered in my family tree right now as a fact, as well as I can establish that my grandfather's grandmother, Katie Anflick, had a sister come to America before she did, marry a fellow named Aaron Schachter, and then when Katie herself came over, that's where she stayed. Or I should say, that's with whom she stayed. And of course, Aaron Schachter and his wife, Anna, had a family of their own. The firstborn was Goldie Schachter, who was born in 1891. Then came Sarah Schachter, born in 1893. And then Marie Schachter, who was born in 1898. The Schachters started their family in Baltimore, then moved to Richmond, Virginia, where they met up with Katie, who just came to America. Around then sometime, I was aware that Goldie Schachter had passed away. She was identified in the 1900 census, but then by the time the 1910 census came around, there's that column where it says number of children born to mother, number of children now living, and number of children born was 3, and then children now living was 2. So you know that, but sometime between 1900 and 1910, Goldie Schachter had passed away, but this was before Richmond had standardized its death certificates, so it was very hard to tell exactly when Goldie passed. But after that time, the family moved in bits and pieces to the Philadelphia area. Lewis, Katie's first son, was pretty much always a Philly boy. I think he did move down to Richmond for a little bit, but moved back. Katie and family moved up to Philadelphia, And then the Schachters moved up to Philadelphia. But Goldie was left behind, as she had died before all the moving happened. And I never knew, when did she die, where was she buried, but I discovered the answer to that question over the last couple weeks. And this was through using FamilySearch.org's experimental full-text search feature. And I'm just putting in names, people I don't know that much about, hoping to see something turn up. And I put Schachter and Richmond, I believe, into the search. And among a lot of other things, one thing that came up was a book. That book was entitled The History of the Jews of Richmond from 1769 to 1917. And this book was published in 1917, and it's available and searchable at FamilySearch.org. It's also available and searchable without login necessary on archive.org. And in a chapter called Chapter L, which is chapter 50 in Roman numerals, it's called the Sir Moses Montefiore Cemetery. And in that chapter, there are several gravestone transcriptions, and one of the gravestone transcriptions is of Goldie Schachter. Spelling is a little different. I'm used to that name being spelled G-O-L-D-E-Y. Here in this book, it's spelled G-O-L-D-A-Y. But I don't believe that's the most significant error here. The date of death is given as September 24th, 1908, which on the surface is plausible. But in the time since I really did a lot of research on this family, someone has gone ahead and posted this grave onto Find-A-Grave. And at Find-A-Grave, the date of death is given as September 24th, 1900, based on the photograph of the gravestone, which was broken, but some of it was legible. The date of death on the gravestone fairly clearly says September 24th, 1900, and that's the date that's entered as the date of death on the Find-A-Grave Memorial. I think the date of 1900 is more plausible because Goldie is buried in the children's section of the cemetery. If she died at the age of 9 in 1900, I think it's more predictable that she would have been buried in the children's section. Rather than if she died in 1908 at the age of 17, I think it would have been more likely that she would have been buried with the adults. So this is just one of those cases where just because something is published in a book, that doesn't necessarily make it correct. It just depends on what that person saw when they transcribed the gravestone. If that person saw 1908, then that's what they put in the book. Or it could have been a typographical error. Maybe the person who transcribed it did so correctly, and then the person who put the book together didn't grab the right numbers for the printing press. But either way, it's very fortunate that we do have this gravestone, even though it's broken, and you can see the way it's broken on Find-A-Grave. As I said before, the children's sections of the cemetery is mostly grass, occasionally punctuated here and there by small gravestones. And this is one of the rare cases in which a child has a gravestone in the children's section. If you take a look at the Find-A-Grave picture, it looks like the person who took the photo did not try to disturb the gravesite at all, because the stone is broken. One part is leaning up against the part that's still stuck in the ground. There is a Hebrew section that's legible, and the person who took the photo submitted that photo to what's known on JewishGen.org as ViewMate, which is a section in which volunteers attempt to read and translate photographs. So this person had a translation done of what was visible of the Hebrew part of the gravestone. Had the photographer gone and tried to disturb the gravestone a little bit in order to see perhaps the English side of the gravestone, the photographer would have had a better idea of the English name and date of death. But the ViewMate translator returned a name of Golda, G-O-L-D-A, without the Y. Actually, the name given is Malka Schachter, with Golda given as a nickname. And the translator wrote that the name could be either Malka or Golda, but I think we know better, and we know that the name is Golda or Goldie, and that she was the daughter of Aaron Schachter, which checks out. So here was another mystery solved, at first by FamilySearch.org's experimental full-text search feature, which found that old book, The History of the Jews of Richmond, from 1769 to 1917, and later by findagrave.com and a volunteer who had the Hebrew inscription of Goldie's gravestone translated. And for my third and final sketch of Lost Souls Found here on Genealogy by Tim, I bring to you the story of Elizabeth Amelia Atwood Hawkins, whose burial at Fernwood Cemetery has been confirmed by a fourth independent source, even though when I went to Fernwood Cemetery to ask where she was buried, they were unable to discover a record for her. And this is on a completely different branch of the family. This is on my paternal grandmother's side. My paternal grandmother, Joan Barbara Harrison, was born 1932. Her father, William Pickersgill Harrison III, was born in 1905. His father, William Pickersgill Harrison Jr., was born in 1874. These people were all born in Philadelphia. William Pickersgill Harrison Jr.'s father, the original William Pickersgill Harrison, was born in 1846, also in Philadelphia. And he married a Harriet Atwood. Harriet Atwood was born in England and moved to America in 1855. She was about 12 years old at the time. She moved with her family, Joseph Atwood and Sarah Allen, and they had four children, all girls. Elizabeth Amelia Atwood, born in 1841. Harriet Atwood, who was my direct ancestor, was born in 1843. Anne Atwood was born in 1845, and Ellen Atwood was born in 1847. So my ancestor, through my paternal grandmother's paternal line, is Harriet Atwood, born in 1843, and her older sister, Elizabeth Amelia Atwood, was born in 1841 and died in 1909. Now, her story is kind of interesting and kind of tragic. She married a Dennis Hawkins in 1868. They had a son, Russell Hawkins. Russell was born in 1870. But Dennis Hawkins died in 1873 while on a business trip in West Virginia. Russell Hawkins turns up in the 1880 census, living at the Girard College, which was a school for destitute boys. And for a while, I didn't really know anything about what happened to Russell Hawkins. I didn't know if he thrived or if he disappeared or what. But Elizabeth Atwood was entitled to pensions from her husband Dennis's Civil War service. And among those documents proving her entitlement to this pension was a note from a Russell Hawkins written on stationery of the Bartram Hotel in West Philadelphia. It turns out Russell Hawkins was the manager of that hotel. And throughout his storied career, he was at one point the CEO of the Diamond Match Company. He was at another point a timber magnate living in Oregon. And at still another point, he was a member of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, appointed to that federal government position by then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but then died relatively young in 1934 at the age of 63 years due to respiratory problems. And he is buried out in Lancaster, where he married his first wife, Lena Ryan. So you have this person who's had kind of a rags-to-riches story, quite a powerful person with his business ventures and federal appointment, but at the same time, his mother lived more on the brink of poverty and relied on this pension, as far as I can tell, for most of her income. I don't see Elizabeth Atwood living out with Russell and sharing in his wealth. And Russell did make some gestures to kind of ensure that his mother was being paid the pension that she was due. But then at the same time, I don't see a whole lot of participation from him in her final expenses. But all the same, it is interesting for me to know and discover where the mother of this fairly wealthy and powerful Russell Hawkins was laid to rest. And when I inquired about Elizabeth Hawkins' final resting place at Fernwood Cemetery, they told me they couldn't find anything. And this is despite Elizabeth Atwood Hawkins's death notice reporting that she was buried at Fernwood Cemetery and her death certificate of September 10th, 1909, also reporting that she was buried at Fernwood Cemetery. So I'm left to wonder, was Elizabeth Atwood Hawkins actually buried at Fernwood Cemetery, as reported on the death certificate and on the newspaper death notice, or was there some kind of last-minute change of plans and she was really buried somewhere else? This month, I discovered an independent piece of evidence tending to confirm that Elizabeth Hawkins was indeed buried at Fernwood Cemetery, and that is the funeral home records of the Frankenfield Funeral Home that operated out of West Philadelphia. And now, how did I come about this record? Well, this was another discovery that I made through the experimental full-text search feature at FamilySearch.org. And I'll link to that in the show notes, of course, so you can try it out yourself. But I initially searched for Pickersgill. The reason being, William Pickersgill Harrison was born William Harrison Pickersgill, and I just typed Pickersgill to learn more about his parents. And this is sort of a brick wall for me. I don't know quite what happened to the parents of William Harrison Pickersgill, a.k.a. William Pickersgill Harrison. So I typed Pickersgill and Philadelphia into the full text search, and there's a lot of results because there was a family that kept that name in Philadelphia, and they had several children, and you'll see their names repeated in the results. But I did find a Frankenfield funeral home record for William Pickersgill Harrison, who died in 1913. Now, these Frankenfield funeral home records are not the original records of the Frankenfield business. They were transcriptions that were made in the 1960s by the Daughters of the American Revolution and are stored at the Daughters of the American Revolution Library in Washington, D.C. So it is always better to find the original source, but in the absence of the original source, I'll take a derivative if it will help me understand some things I haven't previously understood. So in this case, the full text search pulled up a transcription of the funeral home records for the Frankenfield Funeral Home. And the entry reads, for the burial of William Pickersgill Harrison, it says, Harriet Harrison, 4907 Girard Avenue, for her husband, William Pickersgill, car inspector for PRR, the Pennsylvania Railroad, born February 27th, 1846, died April 8th, 1913, burial, Fernwood Cemetery, and then it says large funeral. So I would be interested, you know, if I could go back in time, get in a time machine, I'd be interested to see this large funeral of these people who came to pay their respects to my grandmother's great-grandfather, William Pickersgill Harrison, who was buried at Fernwood Cemetery April 11th, 1913. But having found this record, I thought, I wonder if other family members who used this funeral home also have records available here, and indeed they do. William Pickersgill Harrison's sister-in-law, also Harriet Harrison's sister, Elizabeth Atwood Hawkins, also had an entry in these records, and I can read that record for you. It reads, September 13th, 1909, Elizabeth Hawkins, 4434 Parrish Street, died September 10th, 1909, 68 years old, burial, Fernwood Cemetery. Bill sent to John Burry, 1219 North 52nd Street. Now, it's interesting that this notes that Bill was sent to John Burry, not her famous and wealthy son, Russell. John Burry, I believe, is a mistranscription of John Berry, who would have been a nephew of Elizabeth's. And this gives us an additional clue as to where she might be buried in the cemetery. She may be buried in a plot owned by John Berry. So my next steps with Fernwood Cemetery would perhaps be to get a listing of all plots owned by John Berry. I know that there's one near the rest of the family, William Pickersgill and Harriet and all those. But there may be others elsewhere in the cemetery. I'd like to ask at the cemetery office. I'm looking for this person, Elizabeth Hawkins. I understand she's not represented in your records, but it says here that the nephew, John Berry, paid for the funeral. I'm wondering if he also paid for the the lot? And if that's the case, could you check on all lots owned by people named John Barry? And perhaps we'll find Elizabeth Atwood Hawkins in one of those lots. And it should be noted that Fernwood Cemetery has transcribed all of their records digitally. If you go to the Fernwood Cemetery website, you can do a name search of people buried in the cemetery. Elizabeth Atwood does not show up. Elizabeth Hawkins does not show up. Various spelling variations don't show up. So she is lost pretty good in these records, unlike Selma Anflick, who did turn up after JewishGen.org did a phonetic search. Elizabeth Atwood Hawkins is still kind of lost, but hints as to her final resting place have been uncovered through Frankenfield Funeral Home records that were discovered using FamilySearch.org's experimental full-text search feature. And that's about all I have for you this month on Genealogy by Tim. I just realized I don't ever say my website on this podcast. Maybe I'll start doing that. Genealogy by Tim is at genealogybytim.com, of course. You can visit the website, where you'll mostly find these podcast posts. But occasionally, I post other things, like articles if something interesting happens and I happen to have time to jot down an article about it. And you'll also find a log of Find a Grave pictures that I've taken. And you'll also find my family tree at webtrees.genealogybytim.com. Go visit and enjoy. And you can email me, tim@genealogybytim.com, and tell me what you think. Next month on the podcast, I will be talking all about my First Families application for the First Families Lineage Society at the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. The full-text search at FamilySearch.org has revealed a critical document, a missing link, if you will, that will just about finish off my application to that society. And either in February or March, I can present that research to the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania and see if it's accepted and I become a member of that society. I'll be talking all about that next month. Until then, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits.